ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When the police raided the Stonewall Inn back in 1969, they had no idea that it would eventually lead to the birth of gay pride.
We started standing up for ourselves and said, this is who we are and you're going to accept us.
I'm Mark Fennell and I am the host of the ABC Radio National podcast, No One Saw It Coming. Each week, we unravel a moment in history that changed the course of the world, but, well, no one saw it coming. To hear it, search for No One Saw It Coming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, Damien Carrick here. This is The Law Report on ABC Radio National. This year marks the 50th anniversary of the commencement of the Family Court. The Family Law Act, passed in the dying days of the Whitlam government, created a new court and revolutionised the way Australians divorce. For the first time, no-fault divorce was possible. But the transformation that began in early 1976 has been an ongoing one, with many further changes to the way parents and children move ahead with their lives post-separation. Diana Bryant was the Chief Justice of the Family Court for 13 years, from 2004 to 2013. And Nayim Mushin was a judge of the Family Court for 21 years, from 1990 to 2011. But back in January 1976, they were both young lawyers. Welcome both to the Law Report. Diana, before 1976, how hard was it for Australians to get a divorce? And what did people have to do to get one?
Well, it was pretty hard. There were just a number of grounds. They were all fault-based grounds. I mean, adultery was obviously the most well-known, but there was constructive desertion, cruelty. I might think of some others. Most people got divorced on the grounds of adultery because that, in a sense, was the easiest ground to prove. It was quite difficult, and it was difficult for women. Cruelty, you know, had to be sort of over a period of time.
So you're talking violence, are you?
Violence, yeah. Right, yeah. So it was very difficult for those grounds.
So to establish adultery was difficult. It was an expensive, complicated and degrading process. To illustrate this, we've got an excerpt from ABC's This Day Tonight program from late 1975, which showed a reenactment of how trials worked in a world before no-fault divorce.
That evening, about 8 o'clock, I followed my husband to a certain address in Double Bay.
And what did you find there?
Well, when I arrived, my husband opened the door when I rang the bell, and I walked inside, and there he was in the lounge room with another woman. And she was very scantily clad.
You then hear from the woman's husband in this interaction with the two parties' legal teams.
Well, she was drenched from the thunderstorm, and she took off a dress and put it over the chair next to the radiator to dry.
Did she put on another dress?
No, she didn't.
And could you tell the court what happened after you walked into the room and saw these things?
Well, I was very shocked, and I said to my husband, who's this woman?
Gosh, so you actually had to have evidence of adultery. Nayim, thinking back to those days, did you have lots of private investigators taking photos through Venetian blinds?
Oh, yes. People even, dare I say, colluded by telling the photographer that they'd be in room X of such and such motel at 3 o'clock in the morning. And we got as evidence photos of people having sex through the blinds, and that was how you had to prove it.
Not only were you, on behalf of your clients, employing these people to take surreptitious photos, but sometimes they were staged because people wanted to create a grounds for divorce.
I never knew that they were staged, but I have to say that the suspicions at times were quite high.
Diana, same
sort of thing, probably. Yeah, that probably happened. I mean, some of them, looking back on them, although it was a difficult thing to prove, it was, some of them were quite funny. You can imagine the sort of funny situations that sometimes arose with private investigators running around houses, looking into windows and catching people. We had one who was following people on a golf course and fell out of the tree.
And so that's the kind of the fun side of it. But of course, it's very distressing, isn't it? Because, yeah, you know, in many cases, you're trying to catch out your partner.
Yeah, exactly. And the more difficult part, I think, was what the consequences of divorce in those days. I mean, getting towards the 1970s, and now you may know this better than I, under the Matrimonial Causes Act, the best interest of the child was paramount. But even so, by around about 1976, there were still some judges who were pretty censorious about adultery. And I had one client at least who her husband got a divorce on the grounds of her adultery and she wasn't allowed to have any access to the children.
So not only was divorce only possible when one party was able to establish fault, that fault then was something that the judge looked at in determining custody, as it was then, or maybe even property settlement.
And certainly property settlement, definitely, and costs. I mean, they all just followed the finding of fault.
So you had this idea of adultery, you had this idea of cruelty, that means violence. Back then, judges like the rest of society may have had different ideas about violence.
Absolutely they did. Certainly wasn't as well understood as we would understand it today.
Were there ever situations where perhaps judges might want families to stay together at any cost and maybe see the violence but not see it centre stage as something which is not to be tolerated?
I think we're much better informed about all these things now. I think in those days in the 70s, we were following the mores of the time. People didn't want people to get divorced, and there were judges who were reluctant to provide a decree. The other thing about it is that in the way in which we now understand the concept of the best interests of the child, the way in which the law was applied at that time, in my view, was not as much in the interests of the child as it should have been.
How so?
Well, if you're going to take into account the fact that a relationship has broken down, two people can't get on, and somehow use that for the best interests of the child. At times there was a complete dysfunction between the two concepts. And I think now we are profoundly more advanced than we were then. And I think that's one of the really big things that the Family Law Act did.
We'll come to how it transformed and revolutionised in a moment. There was this third grounds, desertion. That means that one spouse has just simply vacated, abandoned the family, presumably most of the time the husband. How was that established?
Well, again, each case depends on its own facts, and you had to prove that one party had simply up and left. Mm. And when they'd done that, that could establish the ground.
My experience then was that it was 3 years for desertion. If you could wait the 3 years, often you would get the divorce fairly easily because the other party would then consent to the divorce, wouldn't oppose it. So desertion and separation for 5 years, wasn't it?
Separation for 5 years and adultery. They were the main grounds that we used in those days.
I mean, constructive desertion was quite difficult because that was when one party would leave but argue that they had to leave because of the behaviour of the other party, and that was really violence at that stage. They'd have to establish that there was a justification for them leaving and it wasn't their desertion, it was constructive desertion.
Okay, so you could have women leaving a violent relationship and then being at fault or being found to be at fault.
Unless they could then establish that what was called constructive desertion.
And in those days, establishing that violence was even more difficult than it can be today.
Much more difficult.
So the Family Law Act of 1975 allowed no-fault divorce after separation for 1 year. Either party could ask for it and it would be granted by the court. The Act came into effect, into operation, I think on the 5th of January 1976. Now, what was that day like?
Well, I remember it vividly. I was about number 20 in the queue at the desk to file applications for dissolution of marriage. And the queue was in Dalgetty House in Melbourne, and it snaked all the way down the fire escape. There were lots and lots of people behind us, certainly, and there was something like we were undertaking a really big adventure. This was something challenging. We didn't know how it was going to work, and the facilities were very basic and all of that. So there was an excitement, and I think there was an apprehension about it too.
Diana, do you remember?
I remember going down a few days later to a mention, and the judge was sitting at the same level as we were sitting at, and there were sort of pot plants around it. It was very much unlike a court. I was just reminded, we haven't actually mentioned so far that wonderful creature, the discretion statement.
Yes.
Which is wonderful. So if you were getting a divorce, and it applies to everybody, men and women, but if you were applying for a divorce but you yourself had transgressed, and that was usually adultery, you had to file a statement asking for the court to exercise its discretion to grant you the divorce, notwithstanding your poor behaviour. And you had to name the person with whom you'd had sex and yes. And where and when.
Right.
It was a sealed document, allegedly, only seen by the judge at the hearing.
I once did an application for a divorce, and we'd established the ground of adultery, and the judge opened the discretion statement. My client had given her address as a post office box. The judge looked at the statement and said to me, "Mr. Mushin, did all this happen in a post office box?"
So there was an understanding that there was an absurdity here.
Oh, and it is said that some people made people up, you know, made it up and filed this, you know, incredibly salacious discretion statement, which wasn't true for the judge to read. And they come the 5th of January, supposedly there was a bonfire in the Supreme Court building to burn all the discretion statements.
Although I think they might have kept some. But just drawing that discretion statement, drafting it and getting the client to sign it was, as Diana said, we had to name people and be pretty specific about what had happened, where and when and how. And this was could get quite embarrassing. And I mean, one of the things about all this is that is demeaning too. It really did require of people going through this things that today are considered absolutely unacceptable.
You mentioned before, Diana, the pot plants and what have you, and everybody being on the same level rather than a judge at an elevated bench. So you had, you know, this massive backlog, and Naomi, you've described this day, and I think from 1975 to 1976, the number of divorces in Australia doubled. So there was this extraordinary pent-up demand that you're talking about. So this new court was a federal court, the Family Court of Australia, and it was different from the state and territory courts that until 1976 heard family law disputes. And it was also far less formal than other courts. Let's listen to how the Parramatta family courtrooms were described in an ABC report from late 1976.
The parties sit around this semicircular bar table. In this way, they're more involved in proceedings and closer to the judge. There's no clear dividing line between the two parties. The judge doesn't sit as high up above everybody else as he does in the normal courtroom. He and counsel don't wear wigs and robes.
As you heard, the judges didn't wear wigs or robes, and there was no purpose-built courtrooms or court buildings, but rather they tended to be located in commercial office buildings. And there was a lot of informality, I guess, part of the 1970s as well, this kind of hippie idea. Can you describe what that was like?
I remember that very well. In fact, I remember an employee of the building coming in with a watering can, watering the aspidistras in the corner while the case was being argued. So the informality extended to lengths which even the judges really didn't approve of, and quite rightly, if I may say. But we were all finding our feet at that time. We didn't know how to do things, and these were new judges. They were judges for the first time, and they were finding their feet quite understandably. So there was a whole lot of, not really experimentation, but an attempt to make it as workable as possible.
And different, I think. I
mean, that
was the aim of the Act.
Yes.
And the judges who were appointed truly believed in that. And they were, as Naomi said, trying to find ways of making it work and be different and yet be a proper court.
Be accessible, be human, and allow people to work through their disputes, incredibly personal disputes, in a kind of a human kind of context.
That's exactly right.
That was the philosophy. But there was a kind of a cycling back or a reversing, wasn't there?
Yes, we went back to robes. I can't remember. I'd be trying to remember the year. It was
Alistair Nicholson, I think, brought that back, so it'd have to be after
86. Oh, so he was appointed in 1988.
Yes,
so it was after that. And they were purpose-built courtrooms in a commercial building. We didn't get to the purpose-built courts until 1999 in Melbourne and other times in other states. Mm. But they were trying to make it more formal because, in a sense, the informality was giving litigants the understanding that we weren't really serious about that. Now, there are different views about whether that was a good idea or not, but that's what happened. I think it went in the right direction, and to the court's credit, it didn't go over the top in making it more formal.
Because I understand that there was a consensus of a need to kind of shift back to a more formal kind of a way of conducting hearings from both litigants, lawyers and judges, because this is a very serious kind of forum and people perhaps need boundaries as well.
Look, I think they do, and I think that there was some, in some people, litigants' minds, a loosening of boundaries. But I think a lot of this arose from the attacks that were being made on the judges during the 1980s, because it then became apparent that, well, there was suggestion that it was too informal. I think the responses of some of the other courts wasn't as supportive as it might have been. And there was some suggestion in court as well. That's what you get when you have a court that looks like that. So I think that all drove the view that the court should be more formal.
Now, we're talking there about in the early 1980s, there was a string of violent attacks on judges and their families. This excerpt is from 1984, from an ABC News report on the attack on Judge Ray Watson, in which his wife Pearl was killed.
Police say the bomb went off around 8 o'clock this morning. It was apparently a booby trap wired to the front door of Mr. Justice Watson's unit. When the judge was about to leave for work this morning, his wife walked ahead of him to open the front door and triggered the bomb.
Now, almost 40 years later, in 2020, Leonard Warrick was found guilty of 3 murders and a string of bombings in Sydney in the 1980s, and he had been involved in a feud with his ex-wife, so he was a disgruntled litigant. And his victims included Family Court Judge Justice David Opas, Justice Ray Watson's wife, Pearl. I think there was a Jehovah's Witness minister, Graham Weeks, who died, and then there were a number of other people who were injured. So what was that time like for you as judges and for the people you worked with?
Well, I wasn't a judge yet, but I was a barrister, not practicing exclusively in family law, but it was my main area of jurisdiction. And it was a very scary time indeed, because whenever you got a difficult client, and there were plenty of those, plenty of people who didn't want to accept the authority of the court and who didn't want to accept that, for example, they may not be able to see their children as much as they would want to. And there was a lot of angst and a lot of anger at times. And when you had these supremely violent events, you really worried that the whole thing was going to escalate, that this was not going in the right direction.
I had, over the years, for various reasons, I looked at all the records at the time, and I've read the complete transcript of the Pearl Watson's inquest.
This was the wife of a judge.
This is the wife of Ray Watson, who was killed horrifically, planted a bomb at their doorstep. We now know, with hindsight, that it was one person who did all of these things. But at the time, they had no idea that it was, I mean, as time went by, I think he became the main suspect. But when it was happening originally, there were a number of people who were suspects and who could have been, who threatened the court and threatened the judges, and nobody knew who'd done it. And of course, that creates a huge atmosphere of uncertainty and fear, because nobody knew from where this was coming.
And it made for rumours too, so that it was very unsettling.
And did it feed into the wider zeitgeist that some men felt that this court had no legitimacy or was taking away their rights?
Definitely.
Yep, definitely.
You're listening to The Law Report on ABC Radio National. I'm Damien Carrick, and it's 50 years since the Family Law Act came into force. And I'm speaking with Diana Bryant, who was Chief Justice of the Family Court for 13 years, and Nahum Mushin, who was a judge of the court for 21 years. So before we move on, one of the other big changes was the creation of a court counselling service, which I understand was maybe amongst the first in the world. And again, that's part of the 1970s, and that stayed with us. How important was that?
Oh, it was vital and crucially important, and remains so today. I mean, there's various iterations of it, but it's very important today. And it's still be the only court in the world that has that attached to it, and we were regarded very much as you know, groundbreakers in what had been created with the family court.
And they were of a very high standard, and they settled a lot of cases, and when they needed to, they came to court and gave excellent evidence, which was extremely helpful in judges making decisions in cases.
So the counsellors would sit with the parties and get to know them.
So
and
some of the counselling would be confidential, and so nobody would know about it outside that room, but others of it was deliberately reportable, and these were experts. They were psychologists, social workers, who were experts in this field and who came to court and appeared as expert witnesses, as plenty of other people do.
So in the Family Law Act, we have this central idea. I mean, I think most people, if they don't know much about family law, they'll know this, that we have this central idea that all decisions will be made in the best interests of the child. How are decisions about children made before 1976, what was the central principle?
The Matrimonial Causes Act did require the court to consider best interests, but fault somehow or other crept into many of those decisions.
And as I think I said before, bringing fault into a best interests concept, in my view, waters down the best interest concept, because fault is such an artificial term, and it's a judgmental term. It's a value-laden term, which I think is very negative in relationship breakdown.
Yep, absolutely.
And the concept of adultery seemed to be, you know, poor parenting, essentially, so that was a relevant factor.
Right, now, as opposed to two totally independent things.
I think things were pretty much improving by 1976, so most of the time custody cases were determined on best interests, but not entirely even then.
The men say their rights have been stripped bare.
What do we want?
Justice!
When do we want it?
Now!
Ever since the creation of the court, some fathers' groups have argued the system does not put children's rights and interests first. Now, since 1976, there has been a pendulum. The legislation has been amended around the way that the best interests of a child is to be understood. Tell me about that change. There was one particularly in 2006 where you had the presumption of equal shared parental responsibility. In hindsight, what do you think was the reason for that pendulum swinging in that direction at that time?
There were fathers' groups, a lot of fathers' groups who were seeking to have what they saw as decisions which weren't giving them enough time overturned. I mean, my view at that time, and I was doing, you know, right in the midst of all the family law work at that time. I was on the bench by then, but previously. And I don't think that was true. I mean, I think that things were changing. I think fathers were getting more time with children, but it wasn't seen to be happening quickly enough. And so this was a means of achieving that.
It didn't do that in practice so much, but it created another kind of hurdle and complication around which
the
decision-making had to be constructed or spelt out.
I think there were two main difficulties with the change in legislation. The first of them was that it created unrealistic expectations, and the second was the removal of the discretion.
And in May 2024, the Family Law Act was amended to remove the presumption of equal shared parental responsibility in favour of this discretion based on safety and the child's needs. So you welcome that shift?
Absolutely.
It was a winding back of I think, what was unfortunate.
And a proper winding back.
A proper winding back from what was unfortunate legislation.
Yes. Mm.
Of course, the court, since its very beginning and to this very day, has to deal with violence in relationships. How has the court changed over time in how it addresses violence?
Completely, really. I mean, I think along the lines of society too. I mean, the court's views on all this and follows societal views. Society didn't take family violence all that seriously right back in 1975. But as things have progressed, we now have a better understanding of it. It's become more and more important, and it's certainly featured in what the court's done. Over the years, you know, we had a family violence principles that we applied when I was in the court, which was given to judges to help educate them about what they should be looking for. And then I think we learned about other forms of violence too. I mean, initially everyone thought of violence as being physical, and over time we understood that coercive and controlling violence can be equally as damaging as physical violence. The effect of violence on children became much more apparent, and we had a lot of expert evidence about that. So I think over the years it's really made a difference. Now, there are people who will say that it still isn't working as well as it could, but I think the court at the moment's got quite good resources and is able to triage those cases quite well.
Would you say, though, that we're still all on a kind of a trajectory? We're not at the optimal place yet in terms of
how we're a long way from the optimal place. If you read the media on a daily basis, you know we've got a long way to go.
It was interesting. I was trying to find out what the latest data is in terms of self-represented litigants, and that's kind of tricky because people might be represented at one point in a long litigation, and they might not be at another point or at most points in that process. But there's a general consensus that the number of self-represented litigants has increased in family law disputes. What has that done to the family court?
It's put pressure on the court. I don't think the family court's alone in that. I mean, if you look at data from other courts, they're all having the same problem. So there are self-represented litigants in all jurisdictions now, but the family court probably had more and more earlier. And it puts a lot of pressure on because they're often, I mean, some of them just can't afford representation, but a lot of the time they are the kind of person who is, you know, determined to litigate their case. Often they've been unable to maintain a relationship with their partner, unable to maintain relationships with their children, unable to maintain relationships with their lawyer, and they end up representing themselves. And those kind of people often have a very inflated view of how well they can represent themselves, and of course they can't. But they tie up a lot of the court's resources, and that continues to be the case, I think.
But presumably most self-represented litigants are kind of well-meaning people who
They seek to conduct cases in ways that the lawyers can't, so that they're not bound by ethics or the correct rules of procedure and all of those sort of things. And it makes a judge's job very difficult, balancing the rights of the parties where one of them is properly represented and the other is not.
Yep. Especially in custody case, children's cases, you know, where one's well represented and one doesn't have representation, the judge needs to try and balance up the fairness.
So 50 years on, and I should point out there was a recent merger of the Family Court with the Federal Circuit Court to become the Federal Circuit and Family Court of Australia. And I guess that raises other issues that we can't go into in great detail here. But 50 years on, what does the Australian family law system do well and what still needs improving?
Fundamentally, the system still provides for a specialised jurisdiction, and that is really important because overseas that doesn't happen. You rarely find a court which is absolutely devoted to family law. Judges do other things. So we have a very specialist jurisdiction and that remains vital. We also have all of the family consultants in the court.
The counsellors.
The counsellors are now called family consultants, I think. And that remains really important as well. And I think that the ability to actually innovate processes because you have a specialist court is really the main thing that makes it still a very good court in worldwide terms.
Naomi?
Look, I agree. I think the separate family law, specialist family law system is fundamental and world-breaking. We have judges, counsellors, administrators who are working to the very best of their ability, who are under-resourced usually in that they've got too much work to do, but they do it extraordinarily well. And it's a system which I think we should be very proud of.
Naomi Mushin, Judge of the Family Court for 21 years, and Diana Bryant, Chief Justice of the Family Court for 13 years. Thank you both for speaking to The Law Report.
Thank you.
Thanks, Damien. It was a pleasure.
That's The Law Report for this week. Do follow the program on ABC Listen. That way you'll get the latest podcast as soon as it becomes available. A big thanks to producer Christina Kukolia and also to audio producer Elise Simons. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk soon.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.